We're continuing the theme of birthing the heart. And tonight I want to talk about a particular aspect of birthing the heart that I think is a real hindrance to its ease and to its access, and that is forgiveness. Last week I mentioned about spiritual bypassing, where there are certain incidences or occasions or conditions or states of mind that we avoid very deliberately within ourselves so that we can have the comfort we wish for mentally without having to deal with the problematic aspects where we've invested a certain tension. And of course, that doesn't work. Because we don't get away with anything in meditation. Everything comes back to haunt us. We can't pretend that something is not there when it is. Everything has to be dealt with. And one of those aspects of our lives that has to be dealt with is our lack of forgiveness. That is very troubling. That keeps us fixated at a particular time in our life when we did something or something was done to us. And even though decades may have passed between the incident and our present situation, we don't seem to be able to move beyond the grudge, the guilt, the shame that we hold in relationship to that particular incident or series of incidents. Now, I want to just bridge this with a very important understanding of what birthing the heart means. And I want to use a word that I use often because it's such a beautiful word to describe what mental at-easement is, and that's the word homeostasis, which is a science term that means that any system, any closed system, when left alone, will come to balance. Will come naturally to balance. And our mind can be thought of as a closed system in which that is also a valid law that applies to it. Now, instead of thinking in terms of equanimity, which I think is a misappropriated word, we usually think of that word as meaning something I have to do with the mind in order to bring it to balance. Let us think of homeostasis as true balance, when we are leaving the mind alone, when we are not forced to try to counter any energy or any upsetness with a counter indicated method or technique or state of mind that offsets the state of mind that we think is a disadvantage. So that homeostasis, or leaving the mind alone, is really the birthing of the heart. And we flounder there. We don't really know what to do. And the reason we flounder, and the real movement of Dharma, is to get us out of our usual controlling aspect within the mind. We judge it. We condemn it. We shame it. We're always forcing a new wave within the mind. We very, very seldom leave it alone. Maybe in moments of meditation, when you genuinely are simply relaxed and allowing the mind to be what it is, and therefore you as a sense or person involved within the mind is very diminished, perhaps you get a sense of the harmony that is there when the mind is left alone. That is a healed mind. A mind will heal itself from all of the different ways that we have infused our dislike, our energy, our self-deprecation, our criticisms. All of those will heal themselves if we leave the mind alone. Leaving the mind alone doesn't mean that we just go off and do our lives and live our lives without any attention to the mind. The mind, by leaving it alone, We mean leave it alone within full attention. Because the normal way we are inattentive to the mind is we don't leave it alone at all. We continue the torment, the frustration, the impetus to take charge and control and sort of straighten ourselves up through our rigid ideas. And so the mind without attention isn't a left alone mind. It's very much a mind under the control of me. But when we bring attention to the mind, but through that attention we're not asserting any force or will. We are simply abiding within the mind, allowing the mind to express us as it does, as it expresses every aspect in every other condition and data and sense, in every thought, in every physical sensation, and everything else that's arising within the mind. We are an accompanying part of that orchestration. As soon as we think we are a special, as soon as we think we are the conductor of that orchestration, we then assume a place within the mind that is highly privileged. And from that highly privileged posture and position, we disturb the mind and it's no longer in harmony. It's no longer in balance. Do you see that? So what I'm speaking about is a mind in which we see ourselves, the sense of you and I, as a component part of the mind, not as a controller of the mind or not something that's outside of the mind, having a mind to which it controls. It's a part of the mind. It is a display of the mind. It is a thought of the mind. And therefore, it's not reacted to or infused with any more power than any other thought of the mind. This has a direct implication to forgiveness. We have to get this point down, or there will be no forgiveness. We think we are the ones that have to forgive. The mind will forgive itself when left alone. So what does that mean, you see? What does that mean? It's a completely different way to relate to ourselves, isn't it? Instead of trying to carve us into shape and discipline ourselves so that we're the person we believe we should be, we have to have some faith that the mind alone will come into the balance of harmony and within its own perfection by leaving it alone, by leaving ourselves alone. This, you can begin to sense, you can trace this as the method that moves through every single skillful technique that meditation offers. In most of the meditation instructions, we never suggest doing something with what you see, with what is seen. We never suggest getting rid of it or repressing it or avoiding it. We simply suggest seeing it. That's leaving the mind alone. When the seeing doesn't contain a hidden agenda for what is being seen, it in fact leaves that alone. And the mind will come to homeostasis. It will come to a balance in and of itself. It's like a tank of water that has no force pushing the surface any longer. And the waves will settle out on their own. It'll take a while, perhaps, but then the water will hold a kind of serenity and evenness and balance. So too will our mind. This, if there is a key understanding to how to work with ourselves and is at the center of what we have to understand in order for forgiveness to occur, this is it. So it's also, of course, true for every aspect of ourselves that we disagree with, that we don't like. Instead of trying to counterbalance that or shame ourselves or trying to repress it or throw it away or avoid it or hide from it or all. Simply seeing it and leaving it alone. Isn't it amazingly easy? Because it's so amazingly easy, that's why it's so disagreeable for us. We think that we should have more control over this thing, that this should be our product. Our mind is our product. Well, the mind is your product if you think you are outside of the mind with the experience of having a mind. But we're not. We are a thought within the mind. There is no aspect of us that is not a mental experience. When we realize that, when we realize that we're not freestanding as someone, as an entity, with a mental experience occurring, that we are a part of the mental experiences that are occurring, then we can see that the more we assert our position within the mind, the more disturbed the mind's going to be. And the quieter we are within the mind, the more it comes to harmony and the more it births the heart. Now, I'm going to add another component to this, as it's very important. If we don't understand ourselves as being a part of the mind, if we think of ourselves as outside of the mind, then we're going to keep placing demands upon the mind that we think are appropriate, and each time we do, we're going to disturb, let us say, the water container, that we're going to create waves within our mental frame of reference. So what does the sense of self, the sense of I do? Because it thinks it has a privileged place with that's outside of the mind, it tries to establish wants and desires that should be fulfilled, that the mind in itself is not delivering. So we think in terms of desires and wants and our fears and avoidances, and we try to force the mind to come up with that alternative. But of course it can't. Because the mind is not a system. It's not a magical system. Just because you're thinking of a grapefruit, it's not going to deliver a grapefruit. And so the thought of wanting a grapefruit when you have an orange is going to create a wave. And that wave will create an imbalance and a struggle associated with a mind being out of balance. So you begin to see that any thoughts that have to do with time, that is, what is not happening now that I wish were happening now, or what is happening now that I wish were not happening now, those thoughts of another situation other than the one I am are going to create the waves that create the conflict and the struggle of the mind, and the mind's going to be out of balance. Is this understandable? Now, it's not shouldn't be just understandable, it should be applied. You have to apply it. I'm bringing this within reach because we all have a sense of ourselves being somewhere in around our mind, having a mind, you know. But what about if we just surrendered the idea that we were anywhere other than a mental, that we were anything other than a mental experience within the mind? Then we would probably be quieter than we are now. Because we realize every time we came up with a want, a desire, a fear, we were just creating waves and creating the very dis-ease and the antagonist for the mind to heal. And that's why we stay so uncomfortable and confused. We're so tense and tight. It's because we keep asserting our authority over something that's trying to come into balance. But we won't let it come into balance. We keep weighing in. Now, at some point, each of us in this room will realize that fact. And you know what we'll do? We'll shut up. because we realize anything we say is just going to create a wave. And then it gets very quiet. Why? Because a mind that's coming into homeostasis, that's coming into a balance, is quiet. By definition. And therefore no waves are being created. A healed mind is a unified mind, not a fractured mind. Not one thing pitted against another. Not one time frame pitted against the present. That's an unhealed or disturbed mind. I want this means that what is occurring now, which is the parameters in which the mind operates, is now. It doesn't have a then or a will be. It doesn't have a past or a future. It only has what's arising now. And as we think in terms of past or future, we create a tension that the mind cannot sustain. It does the best it can. We think we want a grapefruit. It remembers what a grapefruit is, and it tries to create a future in which that grapefruit will happen. All of that's creating tension and waves, disturbance, struggle. And that's the way it tries to come to some sense of balance, by procuring the thing that it seems to want when its authority is something that seems to be outside of it, called me. Okay, so now we're going to bring in forgiveness. Forgiveness is a mind, the lack of forgiveness, the unforgiveness is an excluded mind. It's leaving a part of it behind. Right? There's some part, some fixation, some time that it remembers in which it does not approve. And it tries to section that off as not being a memory worth having, a repressed memory or a suppressed memory. And so it tries to develop its harmony by excluding, okay, now listen carefully, but the heart is totally inclusive. That is, the balanced mind, the mind of harmony, cannot exclude anything, or it's creating waves within that exclusion. Therefore, the lack of forgiveness is a creating a turbulence, an eddy, often under the perceived currents of the mind, is creating another flow, an eddy, that refuses to allow the mind to settle into its natural harmonic state. So, a forgiving mind is a balanced mind. And what have we done to change an unforgiving mind into a forgiving mind? That's the rest of the story. But first, I want you to get very deeply the sense that the lack of forgiveness is a psychic drag on the mind. And often has a sting of guilt associated with it. Especially if we did something to someone. And if we live with a series, within a series of guilt relationships, guilt is a particular reaction to an incident in which I didn't live up to my expectations within that particular occasion. But if we live within a string of activities called guilt activities, another distortion arises within the mind, and that becomes a quality of how we think of ourselves, and that's shame. If we live long enough with guilt, and we keep perpetuating the story associated with guilt, then that starts adhering to the sense of me when the me arises. And that me then holds, is clothed with shame. Shame is more of the identification of how I recognize myself. It's no longer associated with a particular incident or activity, which guilt was. And now when you're shameful, you wake up in the morning shame. You go through the day shameful. And all of this is an imbalance. Why? Because we haven't fully addressed the lack of forgiveness we have, which created the shame all along the way. And when you're shameful, the world, you're always working yourself up out of a hole. Everything is uphill. You think everybody recognizes the same shame that we feel about ourselves in us. Everybody sees it, we think. And we literally become smothered within that distortion. And each time we assert the truth of our shame, a new wave of imbalance ripples across the surface of our mind. Because not only do we have a sense of I that is a wave and disturbance itself, but the way the I is holding itself as an identity is also creating a wave. So now we have a wave upon a wave. Now you see where spiritual bypassing comes through, comes into the act as well. Spiritual bypassing is the unwillingness to admit what is there. It's there. Remembering that harmony, that balance, is inclusive. Everything has to be owned. Everything is to be seen. Nothing repressed. Nothing avoided. This is very demanding. And if we can just, we feel, if we can just build enough history where we haven't dealt with a particular problem, that the distance between ourselves and that problem, now that history has intervened, will solve the problem. But the problem remains calcified, and a calcified problem is still a problem of disturbance. And it will continue to create waves. But what we have done is created a huge overcompensation so that we don't have to look at that disturbance, which we still sense is there, we just don't admit it, and try to compensate in the other direction so that we can prove to ourselves we're no longer guilty or shameful. Maybe doing good works. Maybe always apologizing for every little transgression you do. I was once working in a nursing home. This was many, many, many years ago. I'd just gotten my master's in social work. And I was just going through the different floors, meeting some of the people who were long-term residents. And there was a woman who was in coma and had been, when I looked at her chart, for 32 years. And I noticed that an elderly woman was always by her side. So I came into the room. I just went into the room one afternoon and introduced myself. asked who she was, and she was the mother, this woman that was in bed in coma, was her child. And as I sat there and we became comfortable with one another, she told me the story of what had happened. Her daughter, at some very young age, like 12, had a disagreement with her mother to such an extent that she went into her room without her mother knowing it and hung herself. Her mother walks into the room and finds her hanging, cuts her down, and of course at that point she had asphyxiated and her brain was essentially barely alive, if alive at all. And 32 years later, I was seeing the mother who was there every single day, all day long, for 32 years. Because she said she could not bear herself, the guilt she felt, unless she was constantly at her daughter's side. So that's an extreme. But let's bring back our own situations, our own turmoil. Not perhaps to that extent. But what is it that we can't, that we keep overreaching, that we keep trying to compensate for in ourselves because of some act at a particular time, in a particular occasion? I wasn't up to what I thought I should have done. And how long has that been haunting us? Forever. Creating the waves and disturbance that keep the mind from the harmony that we're here to see, that we're here to abide within. That harmony cannot occur without us dealing with these facts. I hope you're hearing that. Avoidance of these facts will not bring us to freedom. And so because of that, and perhaps because of the torturous way the toll of shame and guilt has taken upon us, we're willing to do that. Now, when we're willing to do that, we want to know what forgiveness is. We may not know anything about it. We've seemed lost in a confusion of what that might be. So let's talk about what forgiveness is. The first thing it is not is pardoning the wrong. It's not where you say, okay, I've come to the point where I can see why you did what you did to me or I did what you did to me. And I've arranged the story sufficiently so that I can now pardon what I did. It's not a pardon. It's not a reconciliation. Reconciliation takes two. It takes the perpetrator and you, and if you're the perpetrator, it takes you and the victim. It's not sitting down and working out some agreement between the two of you where you have changed what had happened so that you both think it's okay now. It's not okay. It remains what it was in history. You may want to go back and have a conversation with that person to see what was motivating or acting, where they're acting upon or what you were acting upon to get a sense of their wider context of it. But let us not pretend that the situation did not occur, that the act did not happen. It did. So it's not a rearrangement of history. personal story. I was also worked at some point as a school social worker in my early 20s. And it was Christmas time. Right before Christmas vacation, about a week before, and school was letting out that afternoon. And a young boy from the junior high came in to see me, and he was telling me about some problem with his sister, and he was quite upset. And we talked for a while, and I said to him, I will see you after the Christmas break. And he was obviously very agitated and anxious, but it was the day before Christmas break, and it was all the time I had, so I sent him on his way with a promise to see him when we returned. But during the Christmas break, this, I can't remember his age, but say 11-year-old boy, killed himself. Okay, so I come back from the Christmas break and learn that fact. What do you feel when you are the person who is the point person for crisis? What do you feel when a life has been taken from crisis and you're the person that is supposed to solve those crises or at least provide some alternative? That took a long time. But it wasn't from pretending that I didn't do the right thing. I didn't do the right thing. I could have stayed that afternoon. It was a week before. I could have called. I could have done a lot of things. You know, all of this, I should have, I could have, is part of the backlash of the guilt one feels. And in order to be comfortable within one's own guilt pattern, the first thing you have to see is that you didn't act from your standards. Okay? Now, perhaps 1,000 other times, different children that had come to me at different times in which I didn't act according to my standards and nothing happened. And there was no guilt associated with it. But in this particular, it caused a life to end. What do you do with that? And I had to find my way to understand forgiveness. So I want to spend the rest of the time talking about the steps to forgiveness. The first thing we have to do is have the intention for ourselves to forgive. We have to intend ourselves. We have to want forgiveness. Not self-flagellation. Not some, you know, penance. That's not forgiveness. We want to know a heart that is back in balance. I want that. And I'll go through whatever it takes in terms of the incidences that I need to forgive in order to get there. But that's what my intention is to bring the mind back into balance without denying or avoiding anything. The second component is you have to admit what happened without any excuses. You have to see what occurred without any distortion. This happened and this happened, almost the facts of what's occurred. Because the mind, in its memory, will start bringing forth the attitude with which we face that fact as part of the fact itself. And memory becomes distorted by the projection of our own guilt. And suddenly it is weighed all differently. You see? So you have to refresh what actually occurred. That's very important. You have to feel the residue of the emotions that are still there, all of them. What I was feeling at the time, being rushed, wanting just to be free and getting away, all of that. You just feel it all over again. Plus all the emotions that have come since the acknowledgement of what did occur, all of that. So there's a complete opening of the book of this incident, as if you were reading it all over again, page by page. Now what comes in, sometimes it takes distance, it takes a little distance in order for this to happen. Forgiveness, may I say, is often very slow. And it cannot be rushed. What we're letting happen here is we're letting the mind forgive itself. And to do that, remember, if I try to impose forgiveness upon the mind, I'm creating more of the ripple of the lack of tension, the lack of forgiveness within the tension of that need and control. All I need to do is keep exposing what remains that is still unforgiven. And sitting there. But what happens? Something happens in wisdom as we re-expose ourselves over and over again to the reoccurrence of a particular occasion. A couple of things. One is, you see where it is that you acted limited. And that builds within oneself a sort of resolve that you're not going to do that again. Not as some kind of self-condemning response to it or as an overcompensation. It's just that I'm going to be aware if that happens again, if that situation occurs or some alternative similar situation, I'm going to be aware of that. And that's true. That's where the learning occurs. The other thing that occurs that's extremely helpful is you see the situation from which you operated under in that particular time, all of the forces that were working against your cooperative response, led you to act in an incomplete way. And an incomplete act is what's called a human being. Some of them are tragic, like the story I just told. Most are not. Rarely do we ever act in accordance to the perfected or our perfectionism, or to what the situation really calls for many, many reasons. And to live comfortably within our limitations, within our reservations, within our fatigue, within our just general lack of energy, is also a part of the forgiveness. Third, you learn the person who acted that way so many years ago, let us say, is a very different resemblance, has a very different resemblance to the configuration of the person who is here exposing themselves years later to that incident. There's been growth, there's been change, tremendous change. So the person who is forgiving or trying to forgive 10 years later is really not even the same person that did the act 10 years ago. In some ways, who is it that you're trying to forgive? What is it that you're trying to forgive? And who is it that's trying to forgive? And it's very helpful to get a sense of ourselves in motion, learning, growing, as an expanding, moving learning entity. Now, even with all of that, the scene still comes up. It still comes up. And when the scene comes up, what I do is I hold exactly as what's arising, what the memory, the emotions, everything. I don't change a thing. I leave the mind alone. This is the scar tissue, let's say. This is where the wound is still raw. I leave it alone. I let it do whatever it wants to me. I see it without changing a thing. And then it vanishes, tapers away perhaps, to come up at a distant time. And over time, it heals itself through the repetition of our willingness to see it. Not through our willingness to change or our need to be over it, but for our willingness to see it for as long as it arises. And the mind does heal itself. When it's not forced into guilt or shame or self-criticism or remorse, when those waves are continuing to rip and tear the mind from its harmony, it settles back into inclusivity, into harmony, into healing. One final story. A woman came to me in a meditation retreat, and she told me the story of the death of her 8-year-old son, who was playing during recess in the schoolyard on parallel bars. And one of the class bullies grabbed his legs when he was on the parallel bars and pulled him down, and the young boy hit his head and died. This mother grieves as you imagine the mother to. And then she started hearing stories about how everyone was relating to the bully who had done this to her son. And of course, the stories were awful. He was being ostracized and ignored and on. And she came in, this is 2 weeks after the death of her child. She went into that classroom and she said, "I want everyone to befriend this boy, this person. I do not want more tragedy to come out of the tragedy that's already happened." And I used that in myself for the extreme example of what forgiveness can look like. When your heart is no longer focused on the pain of what has just occurred, but you're willing to transcend that pain to help the implication, the implied people who might have actually caused that pain to begin. I leave that with all of us. Can we sit for a minute or two? So leave the mind alone. Whatever you are doing to the mind is the mind trying to do something to itself. It doesn't need that. It knows its way to harmony. Without your assertion of authority, and perhaps as we take ourselves out of the equation, or said better, include ourselves within what is being seen, It settles on its own. The waves settle on their own. We're so used to, in this culture in particular, not trusting that. What do you mean? I don't do anything about this anger, this fear. What do you mean? The reason we're angry or fear is that we've already done too much. So if there are any questions or comments, I'd be happy to. So the question is about metta and not doing anything. So metta is a skillful means. When, for instance, after this tragedy with the son, with the boy who had trouble with his sister, if I had known metta, believe me, I would have applied myself very strongly to that because I was drowning. Okay, and so it was very helpful. It can be very helpful just to stay afloat, just to have some sense of perspective, some sense of another part of you there besides the one that is being, that is so obviously disadvantaged. And so metta has a lot, it sort of levels, it's still a wave, ultimately, but it's a quiet wave, right? It's not as disturbing as the self-reaction. So the metta balances those self-reactions. It makes them more modulated and quieter. And then at some point, the metta ends, and I just stay with the situation as it's occurring. And you have a sense in yourself whether you're up to that task, or whether you need to apply skillful means to help balance the situation sufficiently so that at some point you will be up to that task. You see? So you use it very skillfully. There's no right or wrong in it. There's no should never or should always. It's really a moderated response given how we are responding in that moment to whatever it is that's arising. So always keep it as a tool that you can use, knowing that ultimately we have to leave the mind alone.
I've had this question with me since last week and talking about spiritual bypassing. And I definitely see judgment or the stress of perfectionism being a cover up the shadow of inadequacy. But I also have been kind of hearing this need to control.
It's a harder one. It's, first of all, it's common. So you don't want to be too, you know, you can be over enthusiastic about getting to the end of things. And that actually is a wave creator. All right, so you want to be careful here. The question is around control. And just, you take it on as a friendly and as a curiosity. I just want to start noticing how often I'm in control, right? And how often I assert that control, how often I want to influence. And you start seeing that behind the need to do that is that you want order, that you have certain prerequisites that are very important to you, like order, like top-down authority, like obedience. And you see how important those particular mind, states of mind are to you. Right? So we don't. There's not necessarily a psychological disorder behind it. The disorder is that, you know, we want our way. And we feel like we never get our way. And we feel disempowered. Often it has it's associated with some sense of not being heard or not being seen or not being taken into account. And that can have its derivation when we were early on. Other times it's just an egoic act of self aggrandizement. Just to make sure I'm here, I'm going to assert this authority. You know, there, see? That. Now, just as an act to be noticed. So it can be very subtle, or it can be steeped in a lot of early childhood stuff. If you find that control follows you everywhere and is laced upon everything, see if it has to do with a neediness for power, for self prominence, for to be. You know, to be in control is to have for once in my life somebody follow my orders than me always following theirs. You know, it's that kind of, it can be that kind of. So just get a sense of whether there's an emotional need in that area, in that way. But do it from curiosity. All right? Don't go in with a rifle. Because we realize how our intention forms the confusion and adds to the confusion all along the way. So our intention has to be, I want to understand what's going on here. You know, this is something that's disturbed my life. I see myself, you know, sort of out of balance in this particular need. I want to know what's going on. What is in there? I need to flesh it out. See what's going on. And then you just start, like a bloodhound, you just start being on top of yourself in those situations. And here's a counter. You know, so then one thing I would do is I would offer myself opportunities not to do what I normally do in order to see what I really want to do and how entrenched and attracted that sense of control is. So I walk in the room. And the house, you have kids, you know, is cluttered with toys and everything is disordered. And instead of losing my cool in that moment, I would sit down and just feel how I am with complete confusion in that moment. Right? So I'm complete, because being out of control is, that's like the world is upside down. And so instead, it's very hard to take a seat within that degree of turbulence. But if you have a strong enough intention to understand it, you can do it. And it'll show you what emotions arise within that particular situation that force your actions forward. That's what blame. Blame. You see, you don't. That's a spiritual bypass. I don't want to be accused anymore. I'm tired. You know, it's always my fault. These sentences, you know, that are early childhood experiences, and therefore, did you do this? No, he didn't. You know, it's like that. It's like automatic. It's not sticking here. It's going, you know, because what arises in this is that protective mode in that moment that is like lightning speed. Any other questions? Comments?
Um, seems like if I forgive my selfishness that I'll be uncontrollably selfish, not that it'll resolve. I start thinking about it.
Okay, so the question was, if I forgive my selfishness or fear is that you'll be uncontrollably selfish. Well, you might be. If you're... Selfishness is not... I mean, you may want to look into what selfishness is, all right? You don't want to just, I'm going to forgive my anger, you know? It's not a turning away or a whitewashing and saying, you know, this is okay and that's not... It's looking at it. It's holding it. If you're selfish and you did something from selfish that was unskillful, it's letting that selfishness into your life so thoroughly that you know it from A to B. If you know selfishness, instead of acting from selfishness, which is a reaction to selfishness without knowing it, then through your willingness to participate fully within that selfishness, to come to the end of that unforgiveness, you will know selfishness so well that you will not act from it anymore. You see? But you can't whitewash it and say, I forgive that, I forgive you, you're forgiven, I'm forgiven. I don't even have to do anything. It's not like that. It's not like handing out, it's not like a king handing out, you know. It takes a complete integration of what occurred until there's no movement in relationship to what occurred. And then there's harmony. Does that make sense? Okay, all. Thank you for your attention tonight.